You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. The summer movie season is underway, and for critics and movie lovers, there are a few new releases that have been hotly anticipated. Nope is the latest horror movie from Jordan Peele, director of Get Out, and Where the Crawdads Sing is the movie adaptation of a best-selling novel by Delia Owens. We're rounding up some of the new movies out there right now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen any new movies this summer? We'll extend summer back to, I don't know, April or May, if you would like. Is there one on your list that you're excited about or want to hear more about? Have you seen the new Thor movie? How about that Top Gun that's been racking up big money? Have you seen Nope? And if so, did it deliver on scary science fiction weirdness? If you're a fan of the book Where the Crawdads Sing, how does the movie compare? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Reggie Ponder is a film critic, also known as Reggie the Real Critic. He appears weekly on Vocalo in Chicago and critiques movies for several other media outlets. You can follow him on Twitter at Reggie the Real Critic. Reggie, welcome back to the show.
Rob, how are you?
I'm pretty good. As always, Reggie, you watch the movies, then I live them vicariously through you. You know how this works. How is the summer movie season looking for you overall, big picture?
For me, big picture, nothing really, really wowed me for this summer. But from a box office perspective, we're only about 12% off from 2019. So the people were anxious to get out. They're going out to see the movies, and it looks pretty decent so far.
It seems like there's not this parade of blockbusters like we see this summer. Is that right?
That's exactly how it feels to me. When you look at the top 10 movies out there, and I'll just name them really quickly, you get Top Gun, which you talked about, mm-hmm. Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, Jurassic World Dominion, Minions, The Rise of Gru, Thor, Love and Thunder, Elvis, Lightyear, The Black Phone, and Nope. And I guess people felt that Jurassic World Dominion would be a blockbuster, maybe Thor, Love and Thunder. Of course, Top Gun is the number one movie for the year so far, with over $640 million domestically, and it's, well, I think, $1.2 million when you look at it internationally. So, but nothing, none of these are movies where we're back in that time where you're talking about at least $500 million to $1 million.
Let's talk Thor for a sec. I dimly recall, Reggie, that Thor Ragnarok, you didn't like it that much. It was just like the zaniness didn't work for you. How does this new one, the Love and Thunder Thor movie, compare?
Wow, Rob, you remember that.
I remember things.
So I think that Thor is the right character to kind of bring some of that zaniness. I just am not sure that the writers and Marvel have really figured out Thor's identity that well, in my opinion. And so when you look at something like Guardians of the Galaxy, they brought that zaniness in a way that really worked with all those characters, and I really, really liked it. And I was hoping that with Thor Love and Thunder that they would recalibrate in some kind of way and be able to bring that. And they led with the humor. There was still a lot of action in it, and so for the most part it was a decent film. But I still think they missed on the humor part, and maybe the audience felt the same, because domestically Thor only made $285 million at the box office.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. Well, I saw Elvis. And I really liked the young actor that played Elvis. I thought he had the body movements and his image of Elvis, I thought, was really good. I found Tom Hanks to be very disagreeable. I mean, as a character, he played General Tom Parker, you know. But I'm wondering what Reggie thinks of that movie.
Okay, thanks for the call. I said, yeah, I don't think Tom Hanks played Elvis, did he? But what did you think of Elvis, Reggie?
that's why you need to go to the movies, Rob. But anyway, I agree with her. Is that the young man who played Elvis was really, really good. He had the mannerisms and all of that. I think that trying to look at this from Tom Hanks, the character that Tom Hanks played, which was really his manager's perspective, I felt kind of diluted a little bit of the excitement that you want to see when you are talking about Elvis and what Elvis brought to music. But I think they were smart, is that they did a couple of things. One of the things they did with this movie is to make sure that they addressed the issue of Elvis and where his music came from. The fact that he liked black music and covered a lot of black songs, because that had always been a criticism of Elvis particularly. And they made sure in this movie that that was addressed, and that he had friendships with a lot of people in the black music community. So I like this overall. I would have liked it to be more about Elvis than about the management of Elvis. But I think that the acting in this was good.
Thanks for calling in, Kay. We are talking to Reggie, the real critic, Reggie Ponder, looking at the movies of this summer. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen a new movie over the last couple few months? Or is there something on your radar you're excited about or you want to know more about? Call 800-642-1234. All right, you mentioned Nope, Reggie. My kids have seen this. I will see it, I promise. I want to listen to a clip now from the movie. Daniel Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer play brother and sister OJ and M. Here's a scene where the two of them spot, and I got to say, my kids have reenacted this scene in the car a little bit. They're suspicious of clouds. They see something in the sky.
It's in a cloud. It's in a cloud.
OJ! It's in a cloud!
Mm-hmm.
As the Jordan Peele movie, Nope. Reggie, I understand that you maybe don't want to tell us too much about what's going on. It might spoil our enjoyment a little. What can you tell us about Nope?
Yes, it is very little that you can tell people about this movie without kind of spoiling the experience and what Jordan Peele is bringing to the screen. I'll tell you, it looked like a Western. It played like a horror film. And it had elements of science fiction. And the thing to know about this movie is that there's something out there that this family sees, and they're going to try to find out what it is and get the what they're calling the Oprah shot, that picture that you could put in any big magazine or wherever you, so they can make money off of it. And that's going to cause them a lot of problems along the way. It's scary. It's interesting. It definitely has the science fiction pieces to it. But then Jordan Peele does what Jordan Peele does, is he adds in so many layers that some people will leave thinking, what was he trying to say? And that's problematic sometimes, because you either want to watch the movie and enjoy it for its entertainment value, or you're trying to figure out what are all the messages. And sometimes the entertainment can get muddied by trying to figure out all the messages. I will tell you, Rob, I saw the movie in Charlotte because I so happened to be there. And there was a group of young people in their 20s debating what it meant. And so they liked it, but they still were confused because they were like, well, what did the shoe mean? What did the this mean? And I don't want to say too much. And I think that that's sometimes problematic, because you do want to just enjoy the movie for its entertainment value. But kudos to Jordan for a number one movie, because it was number one at the box office with $44 million at the box office.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Shelly is with us in West Allis. Shelly, hi.
Hey, guys. I'm really enjoying your opinion on Nope. I did see it. I kind of kept falling asleep on it. It was going real slow, but overall, the movie was, I loved the story. But, you know, I found the editing was really poor, and that's what, to me, made the movie kind of not so great. But overall, the story was great, but the film editor, whoever that was, didn't do a very good job. I mean, I saw some mistakes, like when the UFO or whoever, what, the flying saucer, you could actually see the fabric. And I just thought that was, that made it not too, it made it very unrealistic. So Nope was a nope for me, but I was glad to go and see it. I paid full price, which was almost $19, because I just couldn't wow. wait to see it. Because the trailer had me like, it was, I was hanging on a clip just waiting for this movie to come out. I couldn't wait for it to go to the $5, like Market Cinema, $5 Tuesday. I couldn't wait. But like, I kept falling asleep, and I thought, oh, that's how I rate movies. I said, if I fall asleep, it's not very good. And I kept falling asleep, so. But I would like to bring up a movie a couple summers ago before the pandemic came, which was The Invisible Man. I loved that movie. It was so great. I remember screaming a few times. It had me jumping. Those kind of movies I love.
All right. Shelly, thanks for the call. Shelly does see the horror movies some, but you're a thumbs up. Reggie sounds like she's more of a thumbs down on Nope.
Yeah, I liked Nope, but I totally understand, as I said, that there's this mixture of, do I understand it, do I not? And it does move a little bit slow, but I think that sometimes because it moves slow doesn't mean that it's a sleeper. It just means that they're trying to set up some things. And the question is, do you think that they set it up well? And she didn't, and I totally respect that.
Thanks for the call, Shelly. We're talking to Reggie Ponder, a.k.a. Reggie the Real Critic, with us today to talk about new movies out this summer, what's coming up in the next couple months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you seen, like it or not? What are you excited to see? What do you want to ask about? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with film critic Reggie Ponder about new movies out this summer. You can join in with ones you've seen or want to see at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Share a recommendation. Get a recommendation. Back to your calls now. Cheryl is with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi there. I feel like I'm being bombarded with comic book hero movies or sequel movies. I'm missing those Sleepless in Seattle kind of movies, or Breakthrough, or La Bamba. Is there something coming up that's out of that kind of ordinary?
I got you, no. Cheryl. Yeah, is Cheryl out of luck, Reggie, or is there something out there for her?
No, actually, Cheryl is going to be in luck. In terms of the fall season, will have a lot of movies that will be in the realm of counter programming, and not those big. You won't get any of those big superheroes or sequel movies. I will say this before I just mention some of them, is that even when you look at the summer fair, that there were a few movies that they tried to do that counter programming with. Elvis was one of those, because it really wasn't a big, you know, obviously not a sequel and not a superhero movie. You look at Where the Crawdads Sing, the same thing. Downton Abbey, it's a sequel, but it was new, something different. So the studios do recognize that they have to do things that have something for other folks. And so some of the movies that will be coming up are The Woman King, which is in September the 16th, Don't Worry, Darling, which is September the 23rd, excuse me. There's a few others, and I'm just losing them at this moment. But there are a number of movies coming out that are not those big, big movies. There's one called Bodies, 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 A Beast that's coming out, which I'm really looking forward to seeing on August the 19th. It's not that Sleepless in Seattle kind of movie. It's a little bit scary.
Now watch the trailer. It's like Sleepless in Seattle, but there's a lion attacking everybody.
Right. There's no sleeping on that one. I don't think you want to be asleep when that lion comes after you. But there will be lighter fare for sure, and that's going to test the box office. In fact, and the reason it is because a lot of these more counter programming movies, people are starting to watch it on their streaming services, saying, do I really want to go in to the theater to see these other movies that you don't have to see on the big screen?
Cheryl, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Glad we can give you some options. You mentioned, Reggie, Where the Crawdads Sing. Let's check out a bit of this. Here, the Kea, the main character, played by Daisy Edgar Jones, and Taylor John Smith plays one of her love interests, Tate. Here's a listen.
Am I your girlfriend now?
Do you want to be?
I know feathers. But the other girls don't know feathers.
All right, then.
So you didn't read the book, Reggie, I understand, but some people who have read the book were maybe disappointed by the movie?
That's what I would like to know. I will tell you is that when you look at Rotten Tomatoes, the critics overall, and I'm included in it, didn't love this movie. I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it. It wasn't one of those movies for me that I felt like I had to see in the theater. This was one of those movies that I wish I had streamed and would have been fine at home with my wife, watching, having some popcorn, doing that type of thing. However, the audience totally disagrees. When you look at Rotten Tomatoes, the critics were at 34%, but the audience was at 96%. So that tells me that a lot of people who probably read the book really felt that this was representative of that. It felt a little bit Harlequin romance-y to me, and I might be dating myself because I don't even know if Harlequin romances are out anymore, but it felt a little bit like that to me.
We are talking to Reggie Ponder, Reggie the Real Critic, about summer movies, ones that are out, ones that are coming out. Still time if you'd like to get in at 800-642-1234 with your picks and pans, with your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Minions, The Rise of Gru, I think this is one you've seen, Reggie?
Yeah, I saw that. But if I can, Rob, I just want to make one other comment about Where the Crawdads Sing.
Oh, yeah.
Is that it's beautifully shot to me. If you are looking to be kind of transported into that kind of environment, I think the acting was good. It's beautifully shot. It just felt like there was just something missing to elevate it to that next level. But I just had to say that it looks really good. It's a really good looking movie.
Excellent. Okay, so Minions, The Rise of Gru, I'm imagining probably never going to be a double feature with the Crawdad movie.
No, it's not going to be a double feature. And this might be one that most adults will want to skip. This is a movie about a young kid who wants to be a super villain, not a superhero. And he finds a group of super villains. He tries to join their club. They wouldn't let him join their club. So he becomes the superest, baddest super villain out there. And there's this chase to figure out, will he stay that way or will he learn something different? And, you know, these types of movies are all about teachable moments. And it was fun. It was a fun movie. So if you're dragged to it, which many parents probably will be, you'll be like, okay, I got it. Will you love it when you walk out of theater? No, but I think the young people will like it because it stays with the theme of the Minions and expands it just a little enough that it doesn't get away from the core part of that franchise.
Now, coming out now-ish is one I think you're planning to see soon, Reggie, Bullet Train. I just happened to see a trailer for this one. A lot of names in this one anyway.
There are a lot of names, and of course, at the top of that list is Brad Pitt, and this is about five assassins who are aboard a fast-moving bullet train, and they find out that their missions all have something in common. And if you look at the trailer, there's a lot of fighting, so this is it feels like it's part comedy and part action, and I'm all in. I can't wait to see it. I hope it's as good as and as funny and as interesting and interactive as it looks on the trailer. I see this one on Monday, so I'll have a better sense of that. But I'm definitely looking forward to this.
I want to take a couple of minutes, Reggie. You know, there's fall movies come out. We'll probably have you out on again to talk about those fall movies. We asked people earlier this week about movies they like to rewatch and go back and watch again and again. A lot of people shared theirs with us. What are yours, ones you like to rewatch?
Well, so top on my list is the Bourne trilogy. The Gerard Butler one, this number four, no. But then the fifth one, yes. Anything on that Bourne list, I really, really like those movies.
So does it have to have the Matt Damon character as the Bourne?
Oh, absolutely. Matt Damon absolutely killed in this one. Did you like this?
Those I have seen, and I have actually rewatched them with my kids as they were teens. Those were a lot of fun. Sometimes the, like, you know, out of focus, blurry action. I'm gesturing like a crazy action fight scene here. Sometimes that was a little much for me, but otherwise I did like those.
So I really like that. And then totally on the opposite end of the spectrum is Notting Hill. I love this movie. I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy asking him to love me. Come on, how can you not have some tears and just get, they had a really great way of having a great cast that was quirky, and it all worked. Every character in it worked out so well. I really like that movie. So I'll watch it anytime that it comes on. And sometimes I'll pop it in myself. And then the last one that I'll throw in, because I know we're running out of time, is a movie, Love and Basketball. And I love that movie as well. I like basketball, as you know. And then I like love as well. So those movies that I mentioned, I would watch almost anytime.
All right, wrapping up, Reggie, of the movies we've talked about so far or any other that's out right now, somebody says, hey, I want to see a movie this weekend. I'll take whatever you give me. What do you give them?
Okay, I'm going to tell people to, if you're adventurous from a scary perspective, to check out Nope. I will put that warning on it, saying that it might be for you, it might not, but if you're in that horror sci-fi genre, Nope might be the movie for you. The other movie, which I haven't seen, which is Bullet Train, I'm pretty positive that it's going to be fun and exciting and stupid and all that stuff that you think that the trailer shows. So I would check that out as well. And then for people who are looking for that love story, Where to Call That Sings seems to be one of those fan favorites. Again, 96% on Rotten Tomatoes. So who am I to say don't go see it?
Reggie, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Reggie Ponder. Reggie, the real critic, with us today to talk about some of the new movies he's loving or liking, okay, at least this summer. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, sometimes the best way to help yourself is to help others, and there's science to back that up. Find out more with the author of Wonder Drug, 7 Scientifically Proven Ways That Serving Others Is the Best Medicine for Yourself. That's tomorrow on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Respect for Marriage Act would ensure the right to same-sex and interracial marriage nationwide in the event of a reversal from the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll talk with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin about the bill and its chances of becoming law. First, science and technology are sometimes seen as being in conflict with religion and spiritual beliefs. Religions formed long before many of the most important scientific discoveries and technological developments can sometimes operate in contrast to some sets of beliefs. But our next guest says science, technology, and religion can have more in common than we might think, and she's teaching a new class this fall that explores the intersections between them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It's a big topic. How do you think about the relationship between science and religion? If you're a person of faith or spirituality, do you see your beliefs coming into conflict with science, or do you see them working together in ways people might not expect? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Kara Rock Singer is an assistant professor of religious studies at UW-Madison. Kara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, religious studies doesn't always leap into the world of science. What is it that led you to look at the ways these overlap, intersect, and sometimes conflict?
So I like to joke that I was sort of the poster child for the liberal arts education. Coming into college, I was a molecular biology major, and I took a distribution requirement, and I just happened to take a religion class, and I kind of got hooked. And so at some point, I owe it to a wonderful mentor who was a biophysics professor who was also a very broad thinker about the world and said, oh, well, you're interested in religion and you're interested in science, and what about the intersections? And I hadn't quite ever really considered much about that. And now that has become really the basis of my career.
I think a lot of times in the media and in pop culture too, science and religion ends up being science versus religion. We look at the drama, the conflict, you know, the Scopes trial of evolution and religion. It doesn't have to be that way though, does it?
Absolutely. So I think, first of all, let me start with just the big caveat that these categories that we're talking about are incredibly broad, and they're often talked about in terms of that are universal, but scholars are always trying to show how problematic broad definitions are. There's always exceptions, obviously, but in these cases, most scholars argue that fundamentally science and religion are, at least as we understand them and the way that we talk about them in public discourse, are products of modernity, of the West, and are also categories that were intimately shaped, especially in Europe, in relation to each other. So that is my big caveat for saying when we're talking about these things, I'm talking about things that have happened since, say, the 18th century. Right, so that, and if people want to talk about, well, what was before, we can go there. But so with that in mind, I think a lot of early scholarly work on science and religion happened, was really centered around trying to push back at this narrative about conflict. You know, dig into, say, Galileo. You see, actually, you know, it's a little more complicated, for example, this kind of myth-busting approach. And I think subsequently over the last 20, 30 years, people have really started to look beyond some of these canonical categories about, you know, elite European men who are either scientists, these big names, to think, for example, about other religious traditions, other genders, sexualities, races, and how these configurations look more complicated. And so, again, that is to say, sort of these big narratives are always flawed and there are always exceptions, but these exceptions, I think it's not that the exceptions prove the rule, it's that the exceptions in this case, I think, really break down the coherence even of any big claims about conflict.
We're talking to Kara Rock-Singer from UW-Madison, teaching a first-ever class on religion and science and the way they overlap. You could join in with your questions for our guest, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Kara, even narrowing it down to just the last few centuries, it's a big topic. What are some of the specifics you're hoping to get into, say, with your students in the fall?
So I am really interested in even just breaking down the question of what these categories are. So we're going to start off thinking about technology, and I'm going to say, you know, what is technology? And you might imagine we have radios, or iPhones, or Zoom, or all of these things that we're really familiar with. Then the question is, well, what about hammers? You know, what about even the human body as it interacts with the world? I, for one, am a scholar, especially of gender and American Judaism. And so I'll be talking too about things like religious rituals, like the Jewish ritual bath, which is called the mikveh, and the way that that is also a kind of technology that regulates sexuality, but it also controls and separates between what's sacred and profane, these kind of classic categories of religion, and asking students, is this a technology? What's the line between ritual and technology? And all of these kinds of questions that that occupy me in my work as well.
And you've said elsewhere that religion and science are both ways of organizing and making sense of the world around us. Can you talk about that idea?
Absolutely. So I'll start by saying that when we talk about religion as a category, for example, we might mean a religion, like one of the world religions, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, et cetera. Or we might be talking about religion in a kind of more abstract way, but religion as a category that does some kind of work in the world. And there are lots of theories about this. Some of the kinds of things that we might talk about in terms of how religion works is, how does it set relations of value? What matters to people? Another kind of dominant type of theory is, how do we, as I mentioned with the mikveh, how do we separate between what's sacred and profane, or what's pure and impure? We might also think about religion as a way we manipulate and police and control categories of who or what is human. And so we can think about those kinds of ways of working in the world that sometimes overlap and sometimes don't overlap with scientific imagination. So, right, religion might set out a certain set of values, a particular kind of religion, say justice or care, whatever the case may be. And those might be in line with values, because science is also value-driven and it has its own values that have similar aims. So we might think about sort of utopian movements as something that also works towards these same kind of endpoints or end goals. I'm always fascinated, though, in particular, I think one of the big sticking points in this relationship is how faith, which is a really big category in at least some religions, especially Christianity, relies very much on doubt. You have to not know for sure for it to really count as faith. And scientific knowledge generally works on proof, on the elimination of doubt. And very quickly, these waters can get very muddied. We can start thinking, for example, about statistics, which are also a modern invention. And I have been thinking a lot, as most people have been, about, say, risk calculus. We're living through a pandemic. And I think that has brought risk calculus to the forefront of our minds. So we all know a lot about this very intimately, of what it feels like not to know whether there are invisible particles in the air that could hurt you, and deciding how likely or unlikely it is to get an infection or to have those cause a noticeable response in your body, for example. So you might have a high probability of getting infected if rates are high, or you might have faith that you won't get sick. And when you don't, that might be confirmed. And that's where sort of empiricism pops up, this idea that there's something provable that you can test, something that you can observe and show. But maybe you wore a mask and that helped, which maybe could explain it in scientific terms, or you could attribute it to God, and maybe both. Maybe God makes use of scientific tools, or God's works are explainable through science. So I'm going on in this kind of game. It's kind of a performance, but you get the idea. And these are all positions that reflect ones people have taken over the course of history. Religious actors have claimed science as a religious tool and have looked at nature and said this proves the existence of God, for example, or other kinds of elements of that sort of performance are in there. And so I could unwind all of these, but I think you get the idea.
We're talking with UW-Madison religious studies professor Kara Rock Singer about where science and technology overlap with religion and spirituality. You can join in if you would like at 800-642-1234. Do you see these intersections between religion and science in your daily life? Are there things where you appreciate modern technology because it maybe helps you meet with your congregation, say by Zoom, when a church isn't available to you? Are there points where your personal beliefs clash with what you hear from the scientific world? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Kara Rock Singer. She's an assistant professor of religious studies at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, with us today exploring how science and technology intersect with religion in our lives, in our society, beyond. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are these things you've been thinking about? Do you look at religion with a scientific lens in your life? Do you look at new scientific discoveries through a religious or spiritual mindset yourself? Do you see them running into each other or reinforcing each other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kara, I'm interested in your approach to this. We could look, if we're talking about a religion or a denomination or something, you know, with the history of it, the official pronouncements of the institution, if there is one, or kind of from the daily lived experience of the individual believer. Which do you kind of focus on as you teach a class like this?
So I am definitely invested in the second approach, with the caveat that I think what makes the approach to religion as lived, as people live it, is that it's not actually independent of what official elites say. People are always working with this kind of push and pull between what, you know, they're told from elites and what they experience in their lives. So I think it's always that mix, and lived experience incorporates very much what we hear sort of quote unquote from above.
Are there particular, you know, modern day scientific discoveries that you're particularly interested in looking at with your students in this class? You know, we've got this new James Webb telescope, for example, bringing all these images from the galaxy. Of course, new vaccine research. Are there particular zones of science that you are interested in?
Yes, all of those. I mean, I was so floored when I saw those images, and also my social media accounts were blowing up with all kinds of people just reflecting on sort of with the telescope pictures, sort of seeing the origin of the universe. And I think it's exciting that this is happening in real time and you're hearing, you know, podcasts and big news media having these kind of religious-like conversations. So I'm definitely going to work that in. I am very interested myself in the biological sciences and questions around reproduction and women's bodies. So we'll definitely be talking a lot too about things like genetic testing, about reproductive technologies and how these are shaped differently, not only within traditions, but actually local contexts. And lots of questions about, issues around abortion, I think are so important. So I want to really keep the class really tied to what feels important now.
Yeah, that last point, obviously a very big issue now. Different faiths might attribute the beginning of life anywhere from the point of fertilization to a first breath out of the womb and anywhere in between. And there's some decisions we have to make legally that maybe science isn't going to answer that question.
Yes. I mean, I think part of what's interesting, though, is that religion doesn't necessarily, quote unquote, religion doesn't necessarily easily answer that question either. For one, I think even within, say, the Catholic Church, official ideas about when life begins have changed drastically over the course of history. I just read a really fascinating piece in The New Yorker by an author, and I hope I'm pronouncing the name right, Gia Tolentino. From a few weeks ago, it's called "Is Abortion Sacred?" She talks about her own relationship to abortion as a Catholic, and also gives some of that history. Or we might look at places like a book that I'm going to have students read by Elizabeth Roberts called "God's Laboratory." Looks at IVF practices, in vitro fertilization in Ecuador, which is a Catholic country, and there she shows how patients really understand technological interventions as just part of what always happens with reproduction. It's always assisted, whether it's through your family or God. And so there's a way that things get folded in. And so I think also on denaturalizing and problematizing what come to be very cemented positions, showing not only that they're very recent, but also that they're interpreted differently in different contexts, is really one of the strategies I use most often in my teaching, making the familiar strange.
Kara, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kara Rock Singer is an assistant professor of religious studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She was with us today to explore ideas around science and religion. She's teaching a class this fall, first time, on where those intersect and conflict and sometimes support one another. Tim Michels was not a candidate for office until about 3 months ago. Today, he can make a plausible case that by next year, he could be governor of Wisconsin. It's hardly a given, of course, but the millionaire construction executive has reshaped the Republican primary race. As Sean Johnson reports, he's also left many questioning how exactly he would govern.
Tim Michels and his brothers own Michels Corporation, a Brownsville company started by their father that Michels says now employs more than 8,000 people. This business, and Michels' experience running it, is the foundation of his campaign. At a speech in Eau Claire, he tells voters he's not running for office because he has to.
I am not looking for a political career. I'm 59 years old. I am doing this to serve
President Trump didn't have to run for president, but he wanted to drain the swamp. I don't have to run for governor, but I'm going to go turn Madison upside down.
Michaels does not earn his living in politics, but he's no political newcomer. He ran unsuccessfully for state Senate in 1998 and for U.S. Senate in 2004. In the years since, Michaels has remained a major GOP donor, giving to a long list of candidates that includes Rebecca Clayfish, now his top GOP rival. There's nothing novel about Michaels' political outsider approach, but there's a reason candidates make pitches like this. In the right election cycle, under the right circumstances, it can work. Michaels supporter Kim Schmidt of Mondovi, Wisconsin, is in the crowd at Michaels' speech. She says she likes him because he has business sense.
I'm tired of long-term politicians. I think everyone is. It's time for a change here.
To some voters, Michaels' limited record as a politician is an asset. And it's definitely a benefit politically, says University of Wisconsin La Crosse political scientist Anthony Chergosky.
Tim Michaels has the freedom in many ways to take whatever positions he wants because we don't have a lot of past knowledge, at least recently, of what it is that Tim Michaels stands for. You know, he's not tied down to a lot of positions.
But Michaels has a couple other things going for him this year that have given his campaign a jolt, starting with the coveted endorsement of former President Donald Trump. Chergosky notes that Michaels has also been able to use his considerable personal wealth to blanket the airwaves with ads. Through the end of last month, Michaels had funded this ad blitz nearly entirely himself. He gave his campaign nearly $8 million of his own money.
I'm not a politician. I'm a businessman who knows how to get things done. I'm a self-made businessman who doesn't give a rip about the special interests or their money.
There's a reason President Trump endorsed Tim Michaels for governor.
I'm not a politician. I'm a businessman.
Clayfish has responded by attacking Michaels with the help of former Governor Scott Walker, her old running mate and boss.
I'm not criticizing him. I'm just pointing out the facts about his business.
Michaels' business, Walker notes, was once part of a contractors group that fought Wisconsin's so-called right-to-work law, banning mandatory union dues at private businesses. Michaels has also been active in groups that called for raising the gas tax. In an interview with WPR, Walker also brought up Michaels' decision to put his kids through school on the East Coast while his family was living in Connecticut and New York.
Fair or not, Democrats, if Tim Michaels were the nominee, would go after him and question how he can make the points about education in Wisconsin when his kids didn't go to school.
Michael says he bought the homes while Michaels Corporation was working on a massive tunnel project in Manhattan. The family stayed there when his daughter was fighting a rare form of brain cancer. He also pushed back on Walker's other attacks. He says he supports right to work and opposes increasing the gas tax.
This is a political smear. This is political garbage done by desperate candidates, career politicians who are finding themselves behind.
But on some big issues, Michaels won't say where he stands. When asked, for example, whether he'd certify the results of the 2024 presidential election, Michaels dodges. He says he's a businessman, a know-it-when-he-sees-it kind of guy. He'll make the best decision when the time comes. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio's series of candidate profiles ahead of Wisconsin's August 9th primaries continues tomorrow. Read all the profiles and catch up with the latest news on the campaign all online over at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin talks with us about a bill that would ensure the right to same-sex marriage nationwide in the event of the U.S. Supreme Court overturning a past decision on the issue and her ongoing efforts to find Republican support for it in the Senate. You can join ongoing conversations on Central Time over on the Ideas Network Facebook page and get a long list of great movies to re-watch. We're up over 70 comments with a couple hundred suggestions on there. Share yours on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.